Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. I'm Dave Stevens, I'm a business marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. Today we have 5,000 participants across the world. But if it's the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. Of course, if you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be talking about lead qualification with the Director of Precept, James Ely, Head of Marketing at Touchlight, Robin Bodicote, and Joint Managing Director of Mutual Value, Stuart Meister. Lots to cover, so let's get started. Today we continue our A to Z of business marketing. We're looking to give a primer on the very latest thinking, practices and practical examples on every big topic in business marketing land, and we've reached Q. Q stands for qualifying leads. Three speakers will talk on the topic today, starting with the director at Precept, James Ely. James, welcome to the podcast and over to you.
Hello, my name is James Ely. I'm a director at Precept. We're a brand performance business based in Newcastle and London. We work with business owners and senior marketing and salespeople to help them drive growth and sales for their business. So typically, businesses that work with us are often frustrated that their web, digital, brand and marketing efforts aren't giving them a tangible and meaningful benefit in terms of either sales or growth for their business. Our team of digital brand and marketing performance specialists understand those challenges and have been helping our clients, both in and out of lockdown, to ensure that the sales and the conversations don't stop. And today I'm here to talk to you a little bit more detail about lead qualification and specifically how to do that well. But before we talk about the qualification, there's a couple of areas we really believe help agencies nail that qualification piece. Phase one is before that lead generation process even begins. It's ensuring that you clearly understand your target client avatar. That's demographics, firmographics, psychographics, and behavioural. Understand your USP. What is your niche? What problem do you solve? And make sure that you communicate the above in everything that you do across all of your relevant channels. And also don't forget to upsell to your existing clients. This is often missed, and so many clients don't understand the breadth of services that their agencies provide. Phase two is really important to understand what success looks like for you, be that by numbers, profile, sector penetration, and so on and so on. If you can clearly understand what success looks like for you in terms of lead generation and lead qualification, only then can you effectively begin to measure it. So presuming all of the above is in place, we then get to the important bit of this element I'm talking about today, which is the qualification itself. Here at Precept, we use a weighted sales funnel based around some of the principles from Sandler sales training, which puts a huge emphasis on qualifying out, which to many does feel counterintuitive at first, but please bear with me. For us, there are four stages: stage one, pre-qualification; stage two, qualification; stage three, development; and stage four, propose. We also have what we describe as a nurture pot, which we use at every stage. So within that, at any point where a potential target falls out and is qualified out, they go into one of three pots. That's no current fit, unlikely there's going to be any action within 2 years; low priority, a decision is likely to be more than 12 months away; or high priority, a decision is likely within 12 months. So back to our stages, pre-qualification. What are the things that we need to clearly understand at this stage? We need to understand what their business is. What are their challenges? Who do they want to be and why? Importantly, do they fit our target client avatar profile? Are they the type of people we want to work with? Budget. Understand what the budget is. If they're not prepared to tell you what the budget is, budget by bracketing, i.e. talk to them and explain that a project of the like they're describing is between X and Y. that is a good way of understanding whether they will be a fit for you and whether they have the appropriate budget. Similarly, it would be a big red flag to us if, even after that, they don't respond positively. Understand timescales, both theirs and ours. If we took the work on, would we be able to deliver it within the timescales that they're looking for? Understand why they're speaking with you. What is it that's driven to your door? And then from a practical and administration point of view, we always update our pipeline document if they are then to come on board. We also run at this point something called our sort of analysis in or out sheet as a sense check for all of our gut feel around those questions. So is there a brief? Is there a budget? Do we have a mole or network contact or friend inside? Do we have an existing good relationship with them? Do we know who we're up against? Again, for us, if there's more than sort of two or three others that we're up against, we would more than typically walk away because it would indicate that the client isn't sure about who they're looking to work with. Again, understanding if they'd meet us before the pitch. Another red flag for us if they're not willing to have those conversations. And is there a deadline for the project sign-off or launch? Within that, we would then attribute from a revenue point of view 10% of anyone who is currently in that pre-qualification stage, 10% of the revenue within the weighted pipeline. Stage two, qualification. We would then really look to qualify their pain in pounds, shillings and pence. How much is this problem that they've currently got costing them and or how much could it be worth to them in the future? But what we'd always suggest is that qualifying pain in the present and what it's costing them at the minute is often more powerful and emotive tool. Again, revisit the budget and ensure that we're budgeting by bracketing. Are there any specific needs or issues? Again, are they speaking to anyone else? Authority levels, this is really important. And again, workshops are quite a useful way or free audits of drilling that out. Are they the decision maker or are there other people involved in the process? Have we run a credit check on them? Have they wasted our time previously? And also at this stage, we would also insist on agreeing to a post-proposal feedback, whether we've won the work or whether we didn't win the work. We want them to give us clear and honest feedback as to why we either won the work or why we didn't. And again, we would update the pipeline document and move them from pre-qualification to qualification. And that would account for, the budget would account for 25% within our weighted pipeline. Stage three is the development stage, and that's where we would have a pre-brief session with our proposal team. We'd agree format, content, responsibilities and timings. We would check and input the budget sheet, and also at that point have our commercial team to review and audit what's been done to date. And again, update the pipeline document, and once they get to that point, 50% of the revenue for that particular project would be accounted for within the weighted pipeline. We then reach the final stage, which is propose. So that would involve ensuring that the proposal is written, audited and checked over, the proposal is sent, it's saved on our system, and then we would have a follow-up scheduled within 1 week as a bare minimum. If we were aware that timelines were tighter than that, we would obviously schedule that accordingly. We also use something called Close Your File email. You can have a look up this online. It proves really effective, and we would use that if after two chases by email or phone and of a duration of 4 weeks that we hadn't received a response. And that Close Your File email is a very good way of drawing out whether someone's just been too busy to answer your questions or whether something else has come up in the interim. And obviously at that point, you would then find out whether you win or lose the work. If we win the work, we would ask for a debrief meeting anyway, internally, to understand from the client feedback why we'd won or lost. From a winning point of view, we would then they would go to our onboarding and client kickoff process, and then they would also slot into our client retention and growth strategy platform. Similarly, if we lose, we would dire an appropriate follow-up and place them in the appropriate nurture pot, which I referenced earlier. Pitfalls to avoid. I think the biggest one here is not doing phase one and phase two well. That's understanding clearly who your target audience is and what your USP is, and making sure that you've communicated that in everything you do, as well as understanding what success looks like. The benefits of this, from our point of view, we've seen improved conversion rates, less time with clients who may be time wasters, who genuinely don't either understand what you do or see the value for it. less frustrations with losses and chasing dead ends, and broadly speaking, more efficient. In terms of costs to you or your agency business, obviously there is time to set up that clear process and share that with the team. Plus, I think the biggest element is ensuring that you really clearly understand who your target client is and what problems it is that you as an agency solve, and making sure that's all in place. Thank you for listening. Thank you to the BMC for allowing me the opportunity to talk about this. And as I say, my name is James Ely, Director at Precept. And if you have any queries or questions, my email is james@precept.co.uk.
Our second lead qualification expert is Head of Marketing at biotech firm Touchlight, Robin Bodicote. Robin, welcome to the podcast, and over to you.
Thanks, Dave. So just to introduce myself a little bit further, I'm Robin Bodicote, Head of Marketing at Touchlight, a biotech company focused on the discovery and development of DNA-based genetic medicines. Prior to that, I worked for a number of other life science companies in senior B2B marketing roles. Now, a key focus in marketing and business development has always been the qualification of leads. It's something that I have deeply explored and mapped out as I've consistently tried to build the optimal process to serve both the businesses I've worked for and their customers. Now, to me, lead qualification is the process of identifying whether a lead or prospect fits the target customer profile and has a chance of becoming a new customer for a business. Ultimately, the best leads, what I'd call high quality leads, are the prospects who could become successful long-term repeat customers. In addition, for me, I think a qualified lead can be classified as a prospect whose stage in the buyer journey we can clearly identify. By this, we mean, are they just at the education stage? Are they actively looking for a solution? Or are they ready to make a buying decision? Now, it's really important that only qualified sales-ready leads should be passed over to the business development team. You should never pass every lead that comes in through your marketing activity straight to BD, because this could be detrimental to your business. If you think about it a little, if you do that, BD will waste a significant percentage of their time chasing leads that most likely won't go anywhere. Now, they'll also be spending less time following up on the high value prospects, meaning good opportunities could be lost to the competition. So I think this approach could create a level of frustration and disengagement between the marketing and BD departments, as they are not united and ultimately singing from the same hymn sheet. The reality is that over 50% of your incoming leads or prospects will be nowhere near ready to buy from you when they first engage with your business. So marketing must play a key role in the lead management process as the gatekeeper, the intelligence gatherer, and the lead nurturer. It's not simply marketing's responsibility to create leads, but they must also analyze, segment, and progress them through the sales funnel to an advanced stage. And that is what we do in the life sciences industry. Now, I think we understand that people take time to warm up to a buying decision. They don't hear about a product and immediately decide to buy it. They need time to learn about it, explore options, build trust with a company they are considering purchasing from, and then get ready to make that buying decision. This process is common across many industries, and you'll be able to relate to it when you think about purchasing a new car, a new piece of software, or something like that. It's certainly not a spontaneous decision, and it's even less so in the world of B2B with multiple decision makers that you have to contend with. So marketing must own the leads at the early stages of the buying process and then continue to gather additional lead intelligence and then use that intelligence to further qualify these leads. They must also take the role of lead nurturer and drip feed these prospects with the relevant content to help them understand how to overcome their challenges, meet their needs, and ultimately help them build trust with the business, so they are also assisting them with their decision-making. So rather than annoying your BD team with non-sales ready prospects who are only at the early stages of their buyer journey, and also irritating those same prospects with sales messages, I think marketing must take the role of intelligence gatherer and educator. So moving on, all incoming leads need to be qualified. But to do this, I think we know that it's very important that your business defines exactly what it means by a qualified lead. Now, a qualified lead should be a lead that is ready to be handed over from marketing to BD. And a definition that I've worked with in my previous role was that a qualified lead or opportunity, as it is often known, is a project which represents a potential deal which is relevant to the business's services. It could be qualified if the prospect has a specific need that could be supported, there's an associated project timeline, and a budget to deliver that work as well. Now, getting that lead qualification process right means really asking some key questions to your new leads or prospects, regardless as to whether the lead has been acquired via your website form, via a conversation at a conference, through webinar follow-up, or via a request for a free trial, perhaps. The questions that you need to ask in order to qualify your lead will most likely include the following. So here, we're asking, firstly, the question, what is the problem that the prospect is trying to solve? So here we're trying to determine if your business is a good fit, providing a solution to overcome the prospect's existing pain or challenge. If your product or service isn't really what they need, then you may decide to keep the contact in your marketing database, but you certainly won't pass the lead over to BD for further follow-up. A second question, how urgent is this need? Here, we're trying to identify the prospect's timeline. A prospect looking for a quick solution will require more immediate attention than one who is just exploring options in the marketplace. Again, if they're just scoping for information, then the lead will stay with marketing, of course. A third question to ask for lead qualification, do they have budget to support their project needs? Now, not every lead that you receive is going to be able to afford your product or service. I think we all know that. And it's important to find out how much the prospect is willing to invest. This could easily disqualify a lead, of course, if they simply don't have the budget to spend on your product or service. Or alternatively, if they do have the budget, it gives your BD team a really good starting point from which to build there and prepare the proposal. A final question to ask, of course, is who are the key decision makers? Because here, it's really important to know whether the individual who first came towards your business, who generated the lead, is a key decision maker themselves. If not, then who is involved and who controls the budget? If their decision-making process seems too complex or cumbersome, you may decide to walk away. But it's important to know who your prospect is. Are they an end user of the product, an influencer, or a decision maker? If a lead doesn't have the authority to make purchasing decisions or at least have influence and input into that decision-making process, then there's no need for your BD team to spend time trying to close a sale. And the lead should, again, stay with marketing. So they're the four questions that I think are essential for lead qualification. Now, the responses you receive will help you qualify your leads. And one recommendation from me to help you improve your lead generation process would be to develop a lead scoring system, ideally inside your CRM that identifies which leads are most worthy of follow-up. Now, maybe label them as hot, warm, or cold based on their responses to the questions that we've just talked about, but everyone must be aligned around the definitions of each label. If the process could be automated through software such as Pardot or Marketo, then even better. And a lead scoring system can be used to seamlessly track, report, and automatically send out notifications to the marketing department or BD. When prospects or leads hit a certain points threshold. Now, another key point, it's important to remember that lead generation isn't just about identifying the potential customer's needs, requirements, and their budget status, and the complexity of their decision-making process. It also concerns our own perception and beliefs when it comes to certain prospects and leads. So for example, they may have the budget and the interest, but is our product or service really the right fit for them? do we actually want to work with that prospect? Will working with them be rewarding and beneficial? Or are they the type of customer who potentially takes up too much time and resources and generates very little profit for our business? There's no shame in turning away business if it isn't right for your organization, of course. To provide you with an example, in my previous life sciences marketing role, our drug development services appealed to a broad range of companies from small and virtual biotech all the way up to large pharma. However, we knew that our sweet spot was working with small biotech rather than big pharma. So our main focus was always on this specific customer niche. Well, why? Because the small biotech decision-making process is generally more rapid and far less complex than the decision-making process associated with big pharma. When it comes to outsourcing drug development services, biotech will often make a buying decision in weeks or just a few months with few decision makers, whereas big pharma can easily take more than 12 months. And this is because big pharma have a more complex group of decision makers across multiple departments, and you need to spend much more time convincing multiple stakeholders. So if we'd spent all of our time chasing big pharma, I think our sales cycle would have been much slower and our resources often stretched. So when thinking about your ideal customer and who you want to work with, here's where grading can be used alongside lead scoring to ascertain which prospects hit that real sweet spot and really ensure you effectively qualify your leads from both sides. So my final comment here is, when the lead is qualified and the time is right for marketing to transfer a lead over to BD, it's essential that all of the lead information gets transferred with it. This improves the speed of follow-up and can significantly improve the success rate as well. So marketing and BD must work closely together and be aligned on lead qualification definitions, because when departments are moving in the same direction at the same speed, of course, they can reach that destination a lot quicker and most likely with a lot less effort. So that's my contribution, Dave. I hope you and the audience have found it really helpful and insightful. Back to you now.
Robin, that's brilliant. Robin Bodico, thank you very much. Our third lead qualification expert is Joint Managing Director of Mutual Value, Stuart Maister. Stuart, welcome to the podcast, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Look, in order to explain my thinking on lead generation, I think it's important I give some context to it. So just by way of a quick background, many years ago, I was a TV and radio reporter for the BBC, ITN and others. But over the last 25 plus years, I've worked with many, many different organizations, largely B2B, on the way in which they engage their target audiences in a variety of ways. But I want to talk about what we do now at Mutual Value, not as a sales pitch, but in order to give context to my thoughts on lead generation. What we do is we help business-to-business organizations develop trust-based relationships, much deeper trust-based relationships with their clients and with others in their ecosystem based on different behaviors and a different mindset. Now, the reason this is important is as follows. Almost all B2B companies, in fact, arguably all B2B companies, are actually essentially selling a relationship, and all customers are buying one. Now, if you think about almost any good or service that people buy in the B2B space, there is almost always some level of commitment beyond simply the transaction. In fact, what's interesting is even the highly transactional commodities, of course, are becoming managed services in some way. There's an attempt. You know, even my HP are trying to put me onto a managed service contract for the ink in my printer. They're not just selling me ink in my printer. So there is a service that is implied even with products. And of course, even more true around services like legal services, accounting services, or managed services in technology and so on. And underpinning a service is some kind of at least medium-term, if not long-term, commitment to a relationship between the parties. So I would argue, and I've argued this actually for many, many years in my entire career, that actually the key differentiator between most organizations who operate in markets where there are others that can do what they do, the key differentiator is not what they do, but how they do it. And in fact, increasingly in B2B, the differentiator is in the relationship. And I argue with clients, you should be actively selling the relationship as a core part of your proposition. And we know from our research, we've done research into this, that what buyers buy, that buyers we researched listed four things, based things that drive their decision-making in B2B they buy. One is, of course, technical capability. The second is the business case. Not is it the cheapest, but is there a strong business case? The third is cultural fit. So do we want these people to be around here? You know, if you think about technology sale, when things go wrong at 1 o'clock in the morning, do we want these guys to turn up? Do we want to be working with these guys? And the fourth is there a good team fit? The people in front of us look like a team. Guess what? The last two are the reasons they actually buy, because others can do the job, others kind of can be there or thereabouts on price, but it's those two other factors are critical. So the fundamental thing you're selling in B2B is relationship. Here's the odd thing. Almost everywhere you look, even though that's why people buy, the behaviors in business to business, both buyers and sellers, is highly transactional. And of course, this is absolutely true when you're in the world of RFPs, where it's really tried to reduce to transactional buying and selling. But it's true in almost every respect. Lawyers, accountants, whoever they are fundamentally become transactional when they're trying to close a deal. Now, why is all of this important in terms of lead generation? We have an approach that we call building relationship capital, and focusing on the organizations where you can build the most relationship capital with those clients. So instead, whereas a lot of lead generation talks about process and automation, we want to think about who you're trying to generate leads with. Because if you look at the organizations, the businesses with whom you have the strongest relationship capital, that's a great place, of course, to hunt for new business. But secondly, there'll be other businesses like that where you're most likely to build relationship capital. And so the targeting of lead generation, in our view, if you're going to focus on the capability of building relationship, should reflect where you can build the most relationship capital together with a client. And the way you describe those clients may be around classic ways of targeting, you know, around their sector or their size or their spend or their particular requirement, but also it may be around the type of people they are that you're with, that so particularly in large B2B where you're doing large deals, and there's the human relationship is a really important part of delivering the value together. You deliver value together in B2B. You don't provide a service to anyone in those sorts of situations. You provide a service with them. You're interdependent. If they don't do their part of it, you can't deliver your service very well. If you're a lawyer, a tech firm, an accountancy firm, whatever you're selling, you're very dependent on the client in many cases to do their bit in order for you to do your job well. And so there's interdependence. The relationship is critical. And generating the most value means focusing on where you can build the most relationship capital. When you get this right, you're more likely to win the business because you should be communicating around this proposition and this approach. It will actually help you qualify out some prospects in your lead generation, so you won't waste time. So you'll have higher conversion rate with clients you're more likely to do better business with. And here's the thing about automation. People talk about CRM. What's interesting to me is that most people absolutely ignore the R in CRM. It's really CM, because relationship is not what they tend to measure or track in CRM. They track other data. And the only way quality of engagement is often measured is in conversion rates, which is a very, very crude measurement. We actually do believe in, you have to have process. Of course you do. You need process. I'm not decrying any of that. You need to have process underpinning what you do. We actually work with a company very closely called IntraHive that actually build works with the CRM to measure relationship capital, to measure the quality of the relationships. So that what you're looking at is both the process on which you're generating leads, the quality of the meetings that are taking place when you're generating those leads, so that you're more likely to close business with the right people, and the volume of the kinds of meetings and conversations you're having with those right people, which is where IntraHive is so powerful, because it measures the relationship data as well as simply, as it were, the customer management data. So I'm totally not against software. It's a critical part of the process, but I'm arguing for the qualitative thinking around the relationships you're building, the meetings you're having, the conversations you're having with clients in a very adult-to-adult way, because what you're trying to do ultimately is, guess what, create mutual value, not one-way value. You don't win-lose, you don't lose-win, you want a win-win approach where you're creating much greater value together.
Stuart Maister, thank you very much. And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, to James Ely, Robin Bodicote, and Stuart Maister. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, Alex Horn, and Josh Bench. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.